Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bound. On today's programme, we're honoured to have an audience with the Queen of Folk Music, Peggy Seeger, although that title may not agree with her politics. Seeger's career has spanned 7 decades, produced 24 solo albums, many more as collaborations, and enthused and inspired the work and attitude of everyone from Shirley Collins to the shy, fledgling songwriter and autograph seeker who'd soon name himself Bob Dylan. Music was probably always going to be the way for the young Peggy, growing up with a composer mother and musicologist father, and deity-like figures from the worlds of folk and blues, such as Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, were house guests of the Seegers. Peggy herself toured Europe in the 1950s, and after being blacklisted by the CIA for visiting the Soviet Union and Communist China, ended up in London, where she met Ewan McColl. They formed a formidable musical and romantic partnership for 30 years, the first power couple in 20th century music. Seeger's songs were and are political. She wrote the proto-feminist anthem Gonna Be an Engineer in 1970 and continued to write about social issues, women, power and family, all the way up to and including her latest wonderful album out next month, titled First Farewell. It's a collection of flinty, wry and witty songs that tackle age, Seeger is 85, the life lived and not lived, and celebrates family. She wrote and recorded the tracks with sons Callum and Neil and her daughter-in-law Kate St. John. It's a record abundant in life, strength and some beautiful guitar. We're very happy to welcome Peggy Seeger. Well, it's lovely to have you on the programme today. First Farewell is such a wonderful, bright-eyed... It's got a lot of glint in the eye as a record, this one. Did it come out sounding just as you intended? It's very close to the mic. It's a very intimate-sounding thing.
It was recorded at my son Callum's home studio. He did the whole job of producing it, directing it, editing it. Both of my sons do that. They both have full studios. But the nice thing to me about it is that it involved both of my sons and my daughter-in-law, Kate St. John.
The family tradition runs in the Seeger blood, Peggy. I mean, music has touched every single part of so many of the lives of the of your parents, your brothers, and now your offspring as well. Could it have been any other way?
A number of my friends have died recently, not of COVID, but just the way you get very tired at old age and you kind of feel like you're an old clock and you just run down. I've been thinking more and more of my parents and my mother, and I had a really strange thought the day before yesterday that if it hadn't been that my mother died when I was 18, I would not have come over. I would not have gone traveling. I would have finished my college. I would probably have settled down and married or whatever it was. My life would have been completely different. But also, I would have been Pete Seeger's sister, Ruth Crawford's daughter, whereas nothing's wrong with that. I'm proud of those, very proud of them. Two things is that released me coming over to be my own person. But the other good thing is that it gave me a name that's quite identifiable. When I give my name to people, they say, are you any relation to Bob Seeger or Pete Seeger? I've had so many advantages, huge number of advantages. But being part of a musical scene, yes, it was fantastic. I mean, I've been so lucky. I really have.
But I think your two brothers also would be asked if they were related to you. I mean, I think there's such a strong, like the words through a stick of rock around the Seeger name in the folk tradition, right? I mean, it's a fantastic, august family. I wonder how it feels making a new record. I mean, in the folk tradition, perhaps, which is about memory and about oral tradition and about remembering your sort of forebears and forefathers and mothers, are those people with you in the room when you're cutting a new record, Peggy?
With the last record that I made, which I thought was going to be my last, there's a song in it called Everything Changes, in which I remember my mother. And whenever I sing it, I literally see my childhood home. From, we had two of them in Washington, D.C. One with a street that was one block long, and our address was 10,001 Dallas Avenue. So if she hadn't died, I would have been totally different. But she is with me so much. She would have loved this part of my life. She would have loved every part of my life. She'd have been intrigued. She was an adventuress like I am, like I have been. My father was partly deaf, and he could kind of hear every song that I made up. He was just interested in everything that I did. So I do think of them, yes. Yeah. And Pete gave me really nice credit in some of the songs that I made and he sang. I've learned a huge amount from him, especially in this album. It's a less direct album than some of my previous ones. But maybe that's because I'm getting less direct myself, I don't know.
Lyrically, there are some suggestions, nudges towards what you're saying rather than plain speaking, which obviously has been part of your songwriting tradition and part of your craft and lyric writing and stuff. And I wanted to a little bit like the question about whether there are sort of people in the room or in your imagination in the studio when you're making a new record. I wanted to ask you about your words, your lyrics, because so many performers, even songwriters, not just performers, sort of say once you're on stage, they become litany, you know, they become a liturgy. So they've just become the sound that you perform on stage. I wonder for you, though, if that's very different, because they all mean so much. That's the whole point in your work, isn't it?
The only time when these songs are litany is during my daily practice period, when I just run over a lot of songs, often singing them faster than they're supposed to go. If you sing them too slowly, really slowly, it's a practice technique that classical musicians do. If you sing them more slowly than they're supposed to go, you realize you taste the words differently. And then you speed up to too fast. And that gives you something like Gilbert and Sullivan. You know, and so then is when you learn the exact pronunciation without necessarily the thinking. But the real thinking comes when you're in the middle again, where that helps you find out what the pace of it should be. And in my earlier days, I had a lot of trouble with pacing. I've had three or four mentors in my life, but the one I learned a huge amount about performing on stage was from Ewan McCall, and that was with the theatrical techniques that we delved into with the group that he and I formed, the Critics Group. I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
Yeah, and he was an actor before that, wasn't he?
He was an actor and a playwright.
Yeah.
And he travelled with the... He was one of the founders of Theatre Workshop, which is now attributed to Joan Littlewood. But for 14 years, he and Joan travelled together. They invented the theatre. And so he brought into singing on stage theatrical techniques, the way you think about things when you sing them. It doesn't teach you how to sing them. It teaches you how to think about them when you sing. And that helps you not go over the top and get histrionics. That helps you to understand and recreate them every time you sing. And there are many reasons why you would do that. If you're telling a story, you can enter the characters. If you're singing a song, say, like Lubrication, which presumes to be about one thing and ends up being about another, it's humorous, so you're singing tongue-in-cheek. So you think about the quiet humor of that as if you're singing it the first time and you're out there in the audience. There's lots of ifs in performing. It's a Stanislavski technique, the application of the idea of if. So if I was out in the audience, what would I be thinking of that, as it turns out? So Ewan McCall did give me a lot of ways of not getting tired of the songs and not turning them into litany. Occasionally, with my best-known song, which is Gonna Be an Engineer, which has thousands of words, I've never counted them, but it's probably good, I don't know how many, I have caught myself thinking of the shopping list and wishing I could go to bed in the middle of it. I have to watch out for that, because if I start really remembering the shopping list, I forget where I am in the song. But I can produce that song literally without even thinking about it. I've done it so much.
We'll know next time, Peggy, if you start singing about butter, milk and eggs. Something's happened and the fourth wall has been broken, well and truly. There's a truth to that as well, that thinking freshly about perhaps the original writing of these songs and why these songs were written about, or why these songs were collected, because many of them are ancient, that you've sung and been interested in collecting over the years. It's about reconvening, I suppose, with the truth of these things on stage. Do you owe your audiences that, to kind of think afresh every night about the songs you're performing, rather than them simply be the linguistic decorations on nice tunes?
I'm a bit of a misfit in this country, in the folk scene now. When I first came over, I was absolutely in the mainstream. When I came over in 1956, everyone was fixated on Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. And so turning up here, when you hadn't even looked at your own folk music, I turned up with a long-necked banjo, female, 20 years old, with a big song bag of American songs. Many, many of them were from Woody Guthrie and were from the America that they really revered in the skiffle movement. I fitted in then. Now I don't fit in the folk scene, because the folk scene here now is centered on, forgive the term, British folk music, which is where it should be. It's where it should be. So I am on stage as a principal, P-L-E, not P-A-L. The songs that I sing because I got them as a child. Secondhand, agreed, but I got them as a child, and they are so much part of me and part of the whole Western working class movement that I feel that they have some application to the audience here. But I've changed my function, Rob. I'm now much more of an entertainer. I rack it from a long unaccompanied ballad, 6 or 7 minutes long, right through to an explosive song about 9/11, and the audience has to follow. They have to, because that is the way I've developed. But I'm really kind of, well, everybody's a one-off in their own way, but I don't fit in. And maybe that's why people are interested.
Well, long may that last, Peggy. I think it suits you pretty well. And on that idea of, you know, the current folk tradition in the UK being about British songs and things, that was what Ewan McColl felt in those early days about, you know, that the English should sing the traditional English folk tradition. Did your views chime with his at that time? Have they changed over the years?
Well, we both were involved in making that policy. He didn't do it on his own. But I was the catalyst of it. We had a folk club at the Princess Louise in High Holborn. It was called Ballads and Blues. And anything went. Israelis would turn up and they'd sing songs from Portugal. And Italian singers would turn up and sing songs from Brazil. But one of the things that was very common was Cockneys singing Leadbelly. I had heard Leadbelly from I was 18 inches high.
He came to your house, didn't he?
Yeah, he came to our house once. I remember it very, very clearly. Enormous man, dressed absolutely impeccably. I actually saw him and my brother Pete at a concert when I was about 7 or 8. And they were it's a concert in a boxing ring in Washington, D.C. But anyway, this particular night, one of the Cockney singers was doing Rock Island Line, I think it was. And he was singing, Rock Island Line, it's the road to ride, oh, the Rock Island Line, that road. That speed with Cockney accent and Cockney vowels. And I had heard Leadbelly sing, oh, the Rock Island Line, it's the road to ride, oh. He was a prisoner. The Rock Island Line was the train that went by. And when prisoners heard that train go by, that was the symbol of freedom to them. And it was presented to them day after day, hour after hour, near their prison. That does not breed a style of singing, Rock Island Line is the road to ride, or the Rock Island Line is... To me, the singing with in the Cockney manner was so ridiculous that it was hilarious. And I started to laugh while he was singing, and it turned to hysterics. I had to be taken out of the room. I could not stop laughing. So the following week, a group of the regulars who came to the club and some of the singers said, "Peggy, you can't start laughing in the middle of someone singing." And I said, "But I grew up with the Leadbelly singing this song, and the way he does it is ridiculous." So one of the regulars was French, and he said, "I don't like it when you sing French songs because your accent is not good enough." And then Ewan said to Bert, "Bert, I think you really should stop singing Scottish songs." And then Bert turned to me and said, "I think it would be better if you didn't sing those songs that you've gotten from the EFDSS library." I was stung. And I said to Ewan, I said, "I wish you'd stop singing 'Sam Bass was born in Indiana. It was his native home,' putting on an American accent." So that's what started the policy. On our stage, nothing laughable or uncomfortable to people of other nations. It was probably a beginning of folk music PC. Who knows? So it was very much looked down on. But I reckon if we hadn't started that, we might not have gotten so quickly to so many of the Brits singing songs from here.
It's interesting. You call it folk music PC. People talk about it now as a cultural appropriation, don't they? And even people say, well, the Stones shouldn't be singing blues, black blues songs and things like that. It's a really precise political point people are making, I guess.
In America, white people have adapted that for centuries. They've had centuries for white people to be singing that, and white people to be mixing with black people, and white people who are brought up literally in among black people. Let's face it, my grandfather was poor white trash, and poor white trash has every right to sing blues as much as poor black trash. They were in similar position, and if they'd been brought up literally among it and brought up with it, singing it, part of it, which you are in America, I think it gives you, but, singing as if you're black, now that's something different.
It's fascinating. You mentioning, you're at the Nexus, and you've had contact and connections with so many of these amazing people. You mentioned Leadbelly turned up to your house. You remember that when you were a kid. I've been reading J.P. Bean's Singing from the Floor. And he talks about, and you're quoted in that at length, Peggy, talking about Woody Guthrie himself coming to your house and treating his guitar like a little dachshund or something on a piece of string. How about that? Can you recollect that for us, perhaps? Because it's just amazing. It feels like these people have sort of touched you in so many ways and sort of set you off on this path, perhaps.
Well, I only remember him coming once. I remember Leadbelly coming to the door, but I don't remember Woody Guthrie coming to the door. But I do remember him in front of our, in front of our fireplace, dragging his guitar around by its strap, and talking to it as if it was a dog, and barking so that it would answer. He was little. I think he was probably about 5'1", 5'2", and I would have been somewhere as short of 8 years old, so that's pretty close to the same. But I wouldn't say I knew Woody Guthrie or I knew Leadbelly, because I didn't. The big one that I knew was Alan Lomax, and he came year after year after year, and then I knew him when I came over here again, and he was the biggie over here for starting the folk revival. When he came, a lot of the singers over here didn't even know each other. He got them all together and got them on radio and recorded them and got them singing together and working together.
And you also so central to this idea of collecting songs and also surveying the folk clubs. And you found in those latter years, the 1950s, there's something like 3,000 folk clubs in Britain.
That wasn't in the 1950s. That was the 60s and 70s.
So it went from strength, literally to strength to strength. And it was Alan Lomax, yourself, Ewan McCall, this whole scene that led to that proliferation.
Well, it was a natural thing because the folk songs are so singable And also the pub. It wouldn't have happened without the pub. That's where the folk clubs met. That's why the folk revival over here is so special, is because we had the pubs, which, God help us, we're now losing. I don't know. I can't imagine Britain without the pubs, although it probably helped with the amount of alcohol drunk. I don't know. But but the explosion happened in the 60s, really, 60s and 70s. I tried to make a survey of them at one point, but it was like trying to count the mushrooms in the morning after the night. It was just, they'd go up and down like mushrooms. And a folk club would be formed by someone who had no idea what a folk song was and couldn't sing, couldn't play, but just wanted a folk song club because he'd heard that that was what it, that was the thing.
So the early folk singers and for the folk clubs, this was an intensely homemade environment.
Oh, yes, it was grassroots.
What was the sort of sound and smell of these places like? Because I understand there was also quite a sort of quite a rigid, codified way of being an audience member. You talked about Stanislavski's. Imagine, you know, if you were in the audience, there was a lot of audience participation. I don't know whether you frowned on that or welcomed it.
Oh, good Lord, no, that was different. a folk club is very different from a concert in a concert hall. A folk club is a whole stack of people like getting together for a wedding or a funeral. You know, they get a pint and they nurse it through the whole evening and they sing. They come in and they go out. People don't do that during a concert. A concert is very formal. Concerts is more different. It is a different kettle of fish. But once you start singing the song, then you're into the... At least I am in Stanislavski. I'm not saying other people need to do this. I'm just saying that I do it. It's the only way that you get past singing the same song over and over and over. But I try not to sing the same song over and over and over, unless it's just been made up and it's topical and it's going to be out of date day after tomorrow. So I'm trying to make up songs now that are not out of date day after tomorrow. I'm not very good at that anymore. I used to make up a song for this issue and that issue and the other issue. But there are issues now that you can almost create songs for that are ecological principles, like lubrication, where you start thinking it's about sexual stuff and it turns out it's about tectonic plates. And the world works like sex does, is that you need people to get along and for things to go smoothly. And just that concept can seem very funny. You figure out how to do that. You keep talking about the album as if it was conceived from the beginning, but it wasn't. How I Long for Peace, which is a cry for the end of war, I made that song up about 15 years ago. I just never recorded it. I haven't recorded all the songs I've made up. The one that ends it, Gotta Get Home by Midnight, that's about 4 years old, 5 years old, and I created it specifically, egotistically, as an encore.
What can we glean from an album title, Peggy, like First Farewell, on that note?
Okay, it was tongue-in-cheek. My brother Mike was a member of the New Lost City Ramblers, an iconic group of the 1960s, 70s, 80s. And I believe that, I mean, I think they broke up but then got together later on every now and then for their annual farewell concert. Now, an annual farewell concert is... So I wanted to imitate that with a first farewell, because when you're saying goodbye to someone at the airport, you hug them, and then you stand there and you watch them go down the little tunnel, and then they turn. This is what's happened with all my family. They turn and say goodbye again. So I'm 85 and I turn on the radio nearly every day and hear somebody of 84, 86, 81, 88, 91 who's died, somebody I know. And so being 85... You could easily do a first farewell, and that opens the door for a second farewell.
Good to hear it. And just going back to the new record then, Peggy, what What's the itch that needs to be scratched for you to get into the studio and lay down these tracks, some of which might be written for it, as you say, some of it might be decades old or 15 years old. What's the feeling you get to have to bring them all together?
I've made about 23 solo albums. This is a solo with me singing most of them. I think Callum, singing them. But there wasn't an... If there was any itch, it was my son kicking me in the backside saying it's time for another album. And me saying, no, I can't sing well enough anymore because my voice has gone down about a fifth. I can't sing the way I used to, even though I practice every day and I try. There's notes in the middle I can't get properly. But Callum said, it's time to make another album. And I said, no. And he said, well, let's record some of the songs you already have that aren't recorded. And at that point, I had The Puzzle. We had Lullabies for Strangers. I had Tree of Love. I had How I Long for Peace, Gotta Get Home by Midnight. And he said, you need to write four more songs. And he said, we need to write more. And you need to write one with Neil. That's my oldest son. And I've never written a song with him before. And on this one, we wrote Invisible Woman. And you might almost say by looking at this album that it shows the parameters of my musical experience and training. The Puzzle is made like a piece of classical music. It goes way out in terms of it doesn't use the usual 1-4-5 chords that you get in folk music. It doesn't have a guitar and a banjo, and there's a lot of piano on this album too. But The Invisible Woman is kind of like a folk song. So I have those two elements in my upbringing. My mother as a classical pianist and composer, and my mother as a transcriber of folk music that was played every day for my first half dozen years, played in the house while she transcribed it. When I work with my sons, we do things that are a little bit more out of the ordinary. I knew I had to write two or three more songs, and doing Lubrication, Dandelion and Clover, and the ones with Callum, it's been a total pleasure. And that, what I would say, is what is different in this album. It has more songs by the family. I don't think there's any songs on this that are made by people who are not members of the family. Yeah, that's true.
It's another family affair, right?
Yes, and also it's going deep down into the emotions and the memories of an octogenarian who's trying to keep going in the only thing she knows how to do well, and that's me.
Oh, how I long for peace among the peoples and the nations. How I long to halt the plunder of the wonders of creation. Oh, how I long for peace.
And Peggy Seeger's new album, First Farewell, is out on the 9th of April, and, situation permitting, she'll be touring in May and June. Monocle on Culture was produced by Holly Fisher. I've been Robert Bound, and until the same time, same place next week, we thank you for tuning in.